Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Born in the 15th century in the tiny kingdom of Wallachia, Vlad the Impaler instituted a reign of terror unseen in the annals of European history. A despot in his own time and a monster long after his death, this Transylvanian warlord set a new standard for violence and oppression. While the rest of Europe was on the verge of a renaissance, the looming threat of a Muslim invasion from the Ottoman Empire transformed this murderous tyrant into a defender of Christendom and a hero of the faithful. Years later, his death remains a mystery, and interest in his life and times are more popular than ever. On this episode, we discuss Vlad Dracula, the Impaler Lord. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 4 of the series, we're discussing game changers, who they were, what they did, and why they still matter. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my Facebook website, facebook.com/BradyJKreitzer, on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and of course, your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we're discussing one of the most enigmatic and misunderstood characters in all of Western history. Who he was in life was monstrous. Who he is in death is downright scary. Of course, I'm talking about Vlad Tepes, Vlad Dracul, or more famously known as Vlad the Impaler. Is he a game changer? Of course, but why? Who was he in life, and why do we think of him as the bloodthirsty vampire of the supernatural realm? Twilight fans, get ready. There is no doubt that even still today, here in the 21st century, I think you could say Vlad the Impaler is more famous and more popular than ever before. But the reality is, if you would ask the common person why we know so much about him, or at least think we do, they probably couldn't tell you, and if you ask them what he actually did, you're almost guaranteed to get a blank response. So who is Vlad the Impaler? Why do we still talk about him? Well, like all people in this season of Game Changers, I think we must first get a real grasp on the world in which Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, is born. One thing you have to understand about Vlad the Impaler is that he grows up in an Eastern European world in one of the most tumultuous times in all of European history. The year is 1431. To give you some framework, you're about two generations before Columbus's great 1492 voyage, just to give you some sense. In Western Europe, you're about 100 years removed from the terrible Hundred Years' War, and you're just about 100 years removed from the last vestiges of the terrible Black Death, the bubonic plague. Now, what is this important for? Well, you must understand Europe in the 15th century is a world of change. A lot of very nasty things occurred in the Middle Ages, but this is a Europe that's very much looking forward. This is a Europe that in some parts are in the middle of a renaissance. It's a movement that, although will impact most Europeans, have very little sway on a person like Vlad Dracul in a place like Transylvania. So let's set the stage a little bit. If you were to look at a map of Europe, you're going to see in the far southeastern corner a very small principality or kingdom, if you want to use that word, we call Wallachia. Now, to give you some idea of what Wallachia looks like on a map, here's what you'll see. To its west is the much more powerful kingdom of Hungary. To its east is a rival kingdom of Moldova. And to its south is the Danube River. Why that's important is because that river will serve as an important distinction, not just between two political powers, but between two ways of life. If you travel to the other side of the Danube River, you're going to move into the swollen and sweltering path of an empire on the rise, an empire actually growing at an almost exponential rate that's really unbelievable. It's the Ottoman Empire. Now, if you know anything about the Ottoman Empire, you'll know that they are the premier Islamic empire of the day. The person at the helm is a man named Murad. Murad is the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. Sultan sort of is a position that embodies all the religious authority of a pope, with all the military authority of a general, with all the political authority of a king, all wrapped up into one. He is the caliph of Islam, the head of the faith, but on a much more practical level, he is the leader of what is one of the world's largest empires, and certainly the fastest growing. Now, as you can imagine, for an Islamic empire, the Ottoman Empire is primarily held in the Middle East, all across North Africa, all across today what is the modern Middle East, as far east as Iraq. But it's also expanding into places where it doesn't traditionally have a footing. And of course, that's Eastern Europe. Places like Greece, places like the Balkans, they're all coming under Islamic control, under the political realm of the Ottoman Sultan. So what's happening in Europe is you're seeing a strange and interesting backlash to this very massive expansion and, in their minds, invasion of Islamic ideology and Islamic thought into Europe. And it's manifesting in a few ways. In Spain, we call it the Inquisition. Many Muslims, Jews, and non-Catholics are being massacred on a daily basis for their religious beliefs all over Europe. I think you can say Christendom, if you want to call it that, the Christian world, becomes a very militarized place. They become reactionary, violence, and an idea or a notion of defending the faith becomes a very critical part of the Christian world. Now, there are many religions that go through this phase. You could probably say the Islamic faith in many places is going through a phase like that right now. You see extraordinary acts of violence, seemingly in the name of religion alone. It's never just in the name of religion, by the way, but all faiths go through this. Again, Christianity in the 15th century is a very outwardly militaristic and martial society. The best version of yourself you can be if you're a man of noble status during this time is to be a defender of the faith, and that means killing any Muslims, Jews, or heretics. That's sort of a person who believes in Christ but practices in a way that is not deemed legal by the church, by the Roman Pope at the time. You have to understand that to understand any of the life of Vlad the Impaler. So now let's set the stage. We'll begin at Vlad's birth, the year 1431. Vlad is born into a very wealthy family of nobles. His father, as the voivod of Wallachia, say that 10 times fast, is one of the richest and most powerful men in the region. And because of that, he's invited to join a very exclusive group, really a social group, only for the very wealthiest and most powerful people of a highly feudalized Europe, we'll call the Order of the Dragon. Now, the Order of the Dragon sounds like a very scary term, and I think Hollywood has played this up a bit, but it really isn't. In a realistic sense, let me tell you what the Order of the Dragon is. Remember, the ideal Christian is a man who fights for the faith in this age. The Order of the Dragon is established by the Holy Roman Emperor. That's a sort of misleading title. The Holy Roman Emperor is basically the leader of Central Europe. He's blessed by the Pope to be the leader of Christendom in its inception about 1,000 years earlier, but that's sort of gone by the wayside. The title stayed behind. It's considered a reverent position. By no means, however, does it make you the most powerful person in Europe. That will be decided by fluctuating political changes. But the Order of the Dragon is created by the Holy Roman Emperor as a means of, again, fighting against a perceived Islamic invasion and threat. It's typically one of many orders you're going to see all across Europe. The Order of the Dragon is one that really takes hold in Eastern and Central Europe more than anything else. You wouldn't see many French or English or Italians as a part of this. But whenever Vlad's father, also named Vlad, becomes part of this group, his name instantly changes because, again, he's given an official title. He becomes Vlad Dracul. Dracul would be Romanian at the time for dragon, effectively. And that's a real point of pride for Vlad's upbringing in Vlad's family, so much so that whenever Vlad, the subject of our discussion today, Vlad the Impaler in the future, really grows up into adulthood, he takes on the name Vlad Dracula, which effectively means the son of the dragon. So, again, very spooky sounding, very cinematic. It's really not much more than a boys' club. But he was proud of it. I mean, it came with an official endorsement of the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, let's get into some of the politics. Approximately 5 years after our Vlad's birth, his father will become the voivode of Wallachia. We've mentioned that. But this is not necessarily a stable position. One of the real hallmarks, I think, of Eastern European nobility is this notion that you can be removed from power any time because there's always someone waiting in line behind you or a rival faction who doesn't like you. And as a result, in the year 1442, Vlad Dracul will be removed from power. Now, there's a couple things he can do about this. Number one, he can stomp his feet and be upset. Or number two, he can make a deal with the reigning power of the day to put him back in place. A power that is so vast and so powerful that no small kingdom or voivode would dare challenge them. And of course, the deal he'll make is with the great and powerful Ottoman Empire to the south. Now again, if you're keeping score at home, I want you to think of this. Vlad Dracul was just made a member of the Order of the Dragon, the defender of Christendom, fighting the Islamic threat, the Turkish threat. What does he do as soon as things go against him? He doesn't go to the Holy Roman Emperor who commissioned this. He goes to the Sultan of the Ottomans, because again, he knows where the real power lies. Well, in the year 1442, Vlad Dracul will be put back onto the throne, but he now owes homage to the Ottoman Sultan. Now, when you think of how the Ottomans will expand into a place like Eastern Europe, I mean, they could do it with big, massive armies, right? And sometimes they'll have to. But in the Sultan's mind, the ideal way he wants to move into one of these new territories is simply by demanding tribute or taxes from the people there and demanding, I think, something like 10,000 local soldiers for his army. Again, first and foremost, this is a political empire. Well, that's exactly what Vlad Dracul will do, and as part of his commitment, he actually sends over his own two sons to live in Adrianople, which is in Ottoman Turkey at the time. Young Vlad is one of these people. Now, Vlad is about 13 years old at the time he goes into the Ottoman world, and this has to be a major change for him. I mean, almost earth-shattering. He's living in a Muslim world. He is what we think of as today as an Orthodox Christian. He's forced to learn military tactics, read foreign texts. He becomes well-studied in the Quran, as any Muslim would. He speaks Turkish fluently. But there's always some sense about him that he doesn't like the culture. He doesn't appreciate the Sultan, who actually he grows to be very close with his son, Mehmet. He doesn't really have a sense that this is for him. Now, his brother, Radu, again, the other son of the voivode of Wallachia, takes right to this Muslim world. He actually joins in totality, in the fullest way, the Sultan's army. He gives himself over to Islam. He sees again, and you can't necessarily blame him, that the new power of the region, the new order, superpower, whatever you want to call it, of the world, is a Muslim, Ottoman, Turkish world power. So in that regard, Radu makes the easy choice. They actually really like him too. They call him Radu the Handsome, and this will come back to play later. But after about 10 years in captivity, again, in a very foreign world, Vlad gets some, I guess you could say, disparaging news. His father is killed. Now, Vlad has no love for his father. This is the man who sent him away, effectively, because he did not care. He felt he was something he could give up. And one of the ways the Sultan wants to spread his Ottoman Muslim empire, again, is not through conquest, but through client kings, effectively. They want someone on the throne in these non-Muslim Eastern European locations that will be beholden to him. Radu seems like the easy candidate for this. Again, he's fully committed to the Ottoman cause by this point anyway. But for whatever reason, we don't have the documentation for this. Maybe it was his strength of character. I'm sure that had something to do with it. The Sultan will send a 20-year-old Vlad to the throne of Wallachia instead. Vlad, again, has lived amongst the Muslim court for almost a decade. The Sultan knows he's not necessarily happy with his treatment, but he thinks that, again, as the emperor of what he thinks to be the most powerful empire in the world, this young Vlad, even though he's in his 20s, will be beholden to him. And for a few years, early on, about 3 years, Vlad seems to play ball. Now, if you want to think of the great debate between Islam and Christendom in the 15th century this way, in a lot of ways, the Danube River, on one side, the Balkans, on the other side, Wallachia, is sort of the front line of this Muslim invasion. And if you're anyone else in Europe, in Christian Europe, the idea that Vlad is maybe a Christian who's friendly to Muslims is a very scary idea. Little do they know, Vlad's acceptance of this Ottoman way of life seems to be a bit of a sham. One of the things that Vlad does as soon as he gets back to Wallachia is he calls together all of the noblemen of the countryside for a great and large dinner. These noblemen have a very specific term in Eastern Europe in the 15th century. We call them the boyars. But he calls the boyars together for a grand feast. Again, he's the new voivod of Wallachia. And they sup and they drink and the partying goes long into the night. And as everyone's getting sort of sauced, I guess you could say, throughout this dinner, Vlad begins to ask some troubling questions for them. He says things like, "How many rulers have existed just in Wallachia in your lifetime?" And they laugh and they joke and they say things like, "Well, too many to count." Some even give us a number of 12. But all of this, and again the questions continue, lead to this idea that Vlad's trying to put forward that there is no stable rule in Wallachia because you people, the boyars, the wealthy elite of the countryside, keep overthrowing them. So again, the party continues, the questions continue, and before long, the boyars who are again in Wallachia begin to realize that this new king may not be as easy to deal with as some of the others. And surely enough, as a statement of his new power, right off the bat, Vlad has them all killed. Now this gets us into a very unusual part of Vlad's history, and after this event he'll be forever known as Vlad the Impaler. And it's this idea that he has this sadistic streak that is not uncommon in the day, but the quantity that he really gives into it really is. But he has all these men killed. He throws some of them off of a mountaintop castle called Poyanar. Others he gives the, I guess, official Vlad treatment of impalement. But this is sort of Vlad's thing. Again, this execution, this death, this calculated use of murder, effectively, on a large scale, is one of Vlad's primary means of displaying his power in a very uncertain age, and sort of bringing in power of a very tumultuous area that doesn't respond well to very strong rulers. Now, when we go into some of the details here, that's not going to sound so practical or benevolent. I mean, this is a real bad guy. But he's a major figure nevertheless, and he is fully embraced by the Christian world. He's endorsed by the Pope. Now, keep that in mind. But one of the ways Vlad likes to kill people, and he'll use this not only against these boyars, but also dissidents in his own kingdom, and Ottoman Turks who will invade later, is something we call impalement. And there's really two ways that works. The first is that the arms and legs of a victim are tied to four individual horses with ropes. As the horses move, the victim begins to lift into the air, and then one of two things will happen. Both involve a large, sharp spike inserted into your body in unpleasant ways. One is through the abdomen. They slice a hole, they stick this large pike through you, and the other is through a less, I guess you could say, desirable way, in an orifice that I won't have to go into. But at any rate, the finished product is a spike stuck in the ground 10 to 12 feet high with a human body impaled on the end of it. And although that sounds very gruesome, it certainly is, believe it or not, most people who are impaled won't die from the actual impalement, from this pike moving through their body, but they'll die from exposure, which either way you look at it is a horrible and terrible way to die. But Vlad will do this on an almost industrial scale. He's said to at one time have 20,000 people impaled on spikes at the same time around him. And it's one of these circumstances where that is not necessarily unusual to see a form of torture that's very public like that done by a leader at this time. Again, it sends a very real, clear message to people who would be challengers otherwise. But just the insane scale that Vlad will do this on sets him apart in Christendom. I think by the end of his life, he was said to have impaled over 100,000 people total. That is not okay by any standard. But when he does this, again, the Pope endorses him because, you know, he might be a monster, but he's our monster. He's a Christian monster, and he's on the front lines of this great Muslim invasion. So that gets sensationalized, and you almost hate to say that because, let's face it, it's pretty far out into what Vlad is most known for. But you have to remember that throughout Europe, aside from these exploits, he's viewed as a hero of the faith. And that's something that we don't often think about. But there are incredible stories that come out of his impalements of political prisoners and enemies. One of them is that he liked to eat dinner amongst this forest of the dead. There are instances where they said he would dunk his bread in the blood of his victims and eat it. Now, right away, that screams vampire to us, right? And that will be a part of it. But it's not uncommon in Eastern Europe, even still today, that blood can be used in a lot of culinary practices, blood pudding and blood sausage and these sort of things. Again, I'm not giving this guy a pass, but he wasn't doing it as a means of being a supernatural beast of some kind. Using blood is not that far out. Using human blood is totally bizarre. But these are the kind of things that we remember about him collectively that other people tend to forget. At any rate, we're going to fast forward a bit into Vlad's reign. And keep in mind, Vlad's entire reign will be during this time when the new Sultan of Ottoman Turkey, a man named Mehmet, a man that Vlad knew in his youth, a man that Vlad's brother Radu the Handsome was still very close with, will be planning an invasion of Europe. With this backdrop as the primary story of Vlad's life, I think this is a really interesting time period. As an imperial historian myself, I love the idea that empires in competition can in some cases bring the best and bring the worst out of each other. Now, in the 15th century, you do have a lot of competition around the world between the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Italians for empire. But you also have this strange unifying factor of an outsider moving in. Again, this perceived Islamic threat moving into Eastern Europe. And it does force them, to a degree, to work together for mutual benefit. Again, they are competitors, but it's one of these sort of situations, united we stand, divided we fall. During this time period, Pope Pius will give a pronouncement at the Council of Mantua. And in that pronouncement, he will say that we must, as Europeans, unify as Christians to fight off the Islamic invasion. And he's doing this in an age where Ottoman Turkey is growing at an impressive rate. And again, almost like a wave washing over Europe, it's coming their way. The Danube River, again, the southern border of Wallachia, is now the front line of this action. The Pope will gather about 40,000 gold coins. He'll send them to King Matthias of Hungary. Remember, Hungary is the neighbor of Vlad's Wallachia. And he will put King Matthias in charge of this defense of Europe. So again, even though Vlad's the primary subject of our story, he is not necessarily the primary figure in the defense of Europe from the Muslim threat. He's very much a secondary player. Interesting, again, keeping that in perspective. And Vlad will tie himself to King Matthias of Hungary as a result. Now, one of the ways that the Ottomans will move into territories, and this is sort of a holdover from the ancient world, it's something that a lot of these foreign or alien empires from Europeans do, is to avoid fighting at any cost. I mean, fighting a military campaign is expensive, it's a drain on resources. If you can get a region to just capitulate through a treaty or through diplomacy, that's the best way to do it. And the Ottoman Sultan Mehmet, and again, he knows Vlad. I mean, they've met before, they've spent years together, will send a group of emissaries to meet with Vlad in Wallachia. While they're there, these emissaries will say to Vlad, "We'd like you to pay tribute to the Sultan. We'd like to take over your kingdom. We will keep you in charge here on the ground, but you will answer to him and pay your taxes to him." And Vlad says to them, you know, in a very passing gesture, "I'll be happy to hear what you have to say, but please remove your turbans." Again, these Muslim emissaries did not remove their turbans. And they said, "Well, it's our custom. Where we come from, we never expose our heads." And Vlad says, "Okay, that's fine." He calls in members of his personal guard, and he nails the turbans to these emissaries' heads. Literally takes a hammer and nails, and nails them to their skulls. And on their way out, they survive this. The nails are very small. I'm sure not that it matters to them. Vlad reminds them that when you're in my castle, you follow my customs. This is effectively a declaration of war on Vlad's behalf. He knows that the Ottoman army is the largest army in the world. It's the best funded army in the world. They have modern weapons. They have gunfire. I mean, they have firearms, for crying out loud, in some cases. Cannons. These are all new things to Europe. And Vlad doesn't necessarily have a very large force. But he's determined to keep Wallachia free and independent. I tend to believe that if a Christian power had tried to sweep in and take him over, he'd probably be equally unreceptive. I mean, he does this to his own people, and sometimes these horrible impalements and mass killings. But he is determined to keep them free from Muslims or Christians, and this is the message he sends to Sultan Mehmet. By this point, I think it's important we clarify, Vlad is building a reputation of his own. He's no longer just Vlad Dracula, son of the dragon, but he goes by a new name in Wallachia, Vlad Tepes, which is effectively Vlad the Impaler. He kills hundreds, if not thousands, of his own people in shows of force. And again, he sends these very detailed and hyper-violent messages to his enemies. Well, from the Ottoman Sultan's perspective, again, someone who plans on moving into Wallachia, taking it one way or another, and taking over all of Europe, in his opinion. He's already taken, for example, Constantinople, the perceived center of Christendom, 10 years earlier. The year is now 1462. Mehmet's going to get this place one way or another, and this small regional voivode, this small regional king, so to speak, is not going to slow him down. If he can take him out of power without committing his entire army and spending what is today the equivalent of millions upon millions of untold dollars, he's going to do that. And in 1462, he'll send a relatively small group of cavalrymen into Wallachia under the command of a general named Hamza Bey. Bey in Turkish, even still today, is sort of a signal of distinction, sort of the way in English you would call someone who's of higher authority to you, sir. The Turkish equivalent would be bey. In 1462, Hamza Bey's cavalry unit, an Ottoman cavalryman, it's called a sipahi, will move into Wallachia. Now remember, Vlad knows the land better than anyone. It's his kingdom. Hamza Bey doesn't. And he takes his men through an essential mountain pass. It's very narrow, it's very tight, where he really, even though he has more men than Vlad, can't really do much to defend him. I mean, this is exactly what the Greeks use at Thermopylae, for example. But this is where Vlad will strike. When the Ottoman Sipahi are trapped in this small canyon or valley, Vlad will attack, and they will have an overwhelming victory. Now, in traditional Vlad style, he's not just going to kill these men and move on, but he's going to make a statement. And one of the things that he does is takes all of them and impales them in a very outward message to the Ottomans. He makes sure that the Ottoman Sipahi commander Hamza Bey is on the highest spike, because he's of the highest rank. That's very polite of him. But from this moment on, whenever the Ottoman scouts go and see what happened to their little strike force of Sipahi in the beginning, and they see this forest of the dead, thousands of men impaled on these spikes, from this moment on, Vlad will have a new title in Ottoman Turkey, and it will be Kazikli Bey. Again, Bey meaning lord or sir, Kazikli meaning impaler. So he is called Kazikli Bey, literally the Impaler Lord. I mean, no wonder we sensationalize this man, right? No wonder we romanticize this man. He has names like Vlad the Impaler, the Impaler Lord. I mean, it's just ripe for a horror writer to come along and say, oh, I don't know, 400 or 500 years, and make him into something else. But this is a heroic stand in Christendom. Remember, this is a man who literally, in some cases, and probably small amounts, for what it's worth, consumes the blood of his victims. And the Pope and Christians all over Europe cannot get enough of him. They love him. Why? Again, he might be a monster, but he's our monster. So in the mix of all of this, one of the things that's lost, and again, as historians, it's important we keep our eyes on the prize, is that Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, is actually, by all accounts, a first-rate military commander. And he understands that he will never overwhelm the Ottomans with his sheer manpower. I mean, the Ottomans have, again, the largest army on the planet. I don't know that if you took all the armies of Europe, they could even still match the figures. It's just that big. So Vlad understands that if he's going to fight these people on his own, he has to be calculated. He has to make effective decisions. He can't fight the Ottomans on the Ottomans' terms. If he does, and we've made this a point in previous episodes of Wartime, the only thing he's guaranteed to do is lose. And even if he does win, it's sort of what we call a Pyrrhic victory, because his army's going to get smaller and smaller each time, and he's going to lose the war. So Vlad will, again, using his past and using his understanding of the enemy, launch a pretty effective campaign in February of 1462. Remember, the southern border of Wallachia is the Danube. The Balkans are to the south. To that point, Mehmet the Conqueror, Mehmet the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, has pushed his armies up to that point. The Danube is by no means an impassable river, but it is sort of the line of demarcation between Christendom and the Islamic world at that point. And Vlad understands how this operates. He understands, again, what he has to do to be competitive. In February 1462, Vlad will disguise himself and his men as Sipahi. Again, Sipahi being Ottoman cavalry. And he moves into the encampments on the southern side of the Danube River. He speaks in Turkish. He remembers how to do this. He speaks it fluently. And he and his men, as they infiltrate the camps, will unleash utter devastation. If he finds a village, he destroys it. If there's people in the village, he impales them. He just, again, burns and destroys a swath, burns and creates a swath of destruction across the southern bank of the Danube River. Not in a battle, but in what is effectively a raid. Even worse than that, just to make his point, he comes back across the river into Wallachian territory, and he does the exact same thing to his own villages on the northern bank of the river. Again, he's killing Wallachians. He's impaling Wallachians. He's beheading Wallachians. Why is he doing this? Well, he's executing what we call a scorched earth campaign, a campaign of total war. And the idea is, burn the farmland, burn the villages, leave the ground fallow. When the Ottomans ultimately do cross the Danube, and they will, there's going to be nothing there for them. No land to feed off of, no farms to pillage and plunder. Again, an army we know marches on its stomach. So if he can't have it, nobody will. I mean, the menace of this man. These are his own people. These are people who depend on him for protection. And he annihilates them on the northern bank of the Danube. Just goes to show exactly why the sadism of this man, the seeming love of inflicting pain, is still legendary today. But we have to view that through a militaristic lens, through an imperial lens in that regard. We have to understand why he's doing what he's doing. Now, there's no justification for it. But in the 15th century, this is sort of what you're left with. Vlad leaves us with this note, and I will read it verbatim. I don't like to do that, but I really want you to get a sense of the man's words in an English translation, of course. Regarding his raid into the Danube Valley, he writes this to the King of Hungary. Remember, King Matthias, he's still operating on his behalf. The Pope gave Matthias the right to spearhead this defense of Christendom. He writes, "I have killed peasants, men and women, old and young, who lived at Oblusitsa and Novoselo, where the Danube flows into the sea. We killed 23,884 Turks, without counting those whom we burned in homes or the Turks whose heads were cut by our soldiers. Thus, Your Highness, you must know that I have broken the peace." I mean, think about what he just said. He not only said that he pillaged and plundered and annihilated this entire region, but he gave a figure of 23,884 people. How could he be so exact? Well, when you're putting them all on spikes and sticking them in the ground, and that takes a while, you probably would have someone keep a pretty accurate count. So that's an incredible amount of damage done, there's no doubt. Now, as you could imagine, that's a bold move. I mean, that takes some serious chutzpah from anyone to do that to the largest empire on the planet, and there will be repercussions. Remember I said that Sultan Mehmed doesn't like to use force if he doesn't have to, but in some cases he will? And after this total annihilation of his advance guard and this raid into the Danube Valley, Sultan Mehmed will make the decision that this king of Wallachia, this impaler lord, Kazikli Bey, must be annihilated. And he sends an army of 90,000 people across the Danube into Wallachia. The 90,000, and this is important, were not 90,000 regulars. They were 60,000 janissary, or regular fighters in the Ottoman world, and about 30,000 irregulars. This begins in the spring of 1462. Vlad can't compete with them on the field of battle. He knows it. So he relies heavily on nighttime raids, sneak attacks, guerrilla tactics, if you would, to negate the overwhelming force of the Ottomans. But eventually, by June of 1462, he's just overwhelmed. He holds up with his army in a tall castle on the top of a mountain called Poyanar, and there he waits. It's sort of his last stand. One of the reasons the campaign into Wallachia is so effective for the Ottomans is because they have people in their army who grew up there, who live there. I mean, one of the primary cities, Târgoviște, where Vlad was effectively raised until he was sent to live in Ottoman Turkey in Adrianople. One of those cities, I mean, those cities are filled with people, again, who are angry at the massacre of the Boyars from years earlier. Remember, Radu the Handsome, Radu the brother of Vlad, is in this invading army, and he's going to have a major part to play in his success, because Radu not only commands military forces, but he brokers agreements and deals with local natives. Again, for them, who do you want to rule you? An Ottoman foreign power who will make you pay taxes but let you live, or a native king who may impale you and drink your blood at any given point? I mean, it's not exactly a difficult trade-off, right, when you think about it. But in any case, hold up in his castle at Poyanar, eventually Vlad has to pack up his things and escape with his life. He'll go into Moldavia to the east, and he leaves Wallachia to the Ottomans from that point on. Now here's where things get really tricky for us, because Vlad, after his escape, will meet with emissaries from King Matthias of Hungary. Again, this is a person who is his patron. This is a person who is one of his primary employers in terms of the defending of Christendom. And he'll suddenly be arrested and thrown into jail for about 10 years, more like 12. And it makes you sort of wonder. And again, we don't necessarily have sources to indicate why this happens, but why does King Matthias of Hungary flip a switch so suddenly on Vlad, who makes these somewhat courageous, if not bizarre and brutal, stance against the Ottomans, only to lock him away? We don't know. I mean, we'd love to have a document that says so, but we just don't know. And eventually, after about 12 years, Vlad is released. He moves back into Wallachia after Radu, who has been in charge ever since, will die. And he'll ultimately be killed by the Ottomans as a result. He'll be beheaded. His head will be placed in a jar of honey, and it will actually be put on a spike in Turkey to show that the great Kazikli Bey, the Impaler Lord, is dead. Now, here's an important question for you. Why did I just make the end of his life seem so trivial, seem so fast? I mean, we talked about it in like 30 seconds. Well, that gets into one of the realities of dealing with Vlad Tepes, with Vlad the Impaler, Vlad Dracula, whatever you want to say. It's because why he's famous happens long after his death. I mean, again, history rarely gives you a great cinematic ending. You usually take the ending wherever you want, and that's your happy ending. Happy endings don't exist in history. But Vlad, in terms of the minds of the Ottomans, was a small regional ruler who was in the way. I mean, he was an especially violent regional ruler, But like all of them, they always get their way. They'll take them out, and eventually the Ottoman Empire will go as far as the gates of Vienna, so long beyond Wallachia. But it's sort of an important point of study here. I mean, Bram Stoker will choose Vlad as his primary villain in 1897 for his book Dracula. And there's a reason for it. I mean, the figure that Stoker creates is nothing of reality. It's complete fiction. It's 450 years after Vlad the Impaler's death. But the man still has such a legacy of violence that the name has some household recognition. So he decides to go with that. And again, the description of the vampire, which is effectively not created by Stoker, but certainly brought into the popular narrative around the world by Stoker, will be indelibly linked to this man. He drank blood. He did these things. It's undeniable. But there's a lot more to it than that. I mean, the circumstances surrounding Vlad's death are still unknown. There was a long-standing reputation in Romania, and they still believe this, so no offense to the Romanian listeners out there, that Dracula's body was at Snagov Monastery. It's on an island in Romania. And studies were tested in the 1970s that showed that beneath the tomb of Dracula was actually no tomb at all. It wasn't there. Rumors persist of where his body ultimately rests, because, again, in the larger scope of his life, the ending was not exactly a triumphant one, and it was sort of a minor footnote in the larger history of Europe and the Ottoman Empire and the competition between them. But because of popular narrative and popular culture, you have this general sense of the vampire Dracula today, which makes him so much more appealing to us. I mean, I'll be very frank with you. There are people, this episode, listening to Wartime, and welcome, by the way, who probably have never listened to any history podcast before, but they saw the name Vlad the Impaler, and they wanted to know more. We all get in somewhere, right? Every episode's an entry point, and that's true for anyone in history. History, you don't know when, you don't know where, but the bug will strike, so welcome if you're here. But this probably brought you here, and you might have heard a story you had no idea existed, a story that dealt with Islam and Islamic invasion and the dialogue between Christianity and the West and Islam that is still very relevant today in many cases. But Vlad was revered in his own time as a hero, albeit, you know, one that a lot of people weren't totally comfortable with, but still he's on their side, for his brilliant defense against Islam. If you go to Romania today, there is an enormous Vlad subculture of tourism there, and they offer some great tours. If you're interested in going, I encourage you to go. You go to these places. You see his birthplace at Zigashwara. You see his place of his raising and his early life and his political center, Turgovishta. You see that great castle of his last stand, Paionar. You see these things, and you see them on the ground. You go to these cities, and you see enormous statues of Vlad. I mean, there's literally giant busts of Vlad's head in the city. And it's nothing about vampires, and it's nothing about drinking blood. I mean, to him, he was a national hero. He wasn't just a historic figure who happened to live there, but a national hero. He defended Europe and all of Christendom against the Ottoman Muslim invasion, whichever angle you'd like to take on it. And he's still a very real presence there. Now, if you go to a lot of these places, places of his birth, his great stand at Paionar, one of the things you will see is literally Dracula paraphernalia everywhere. Little tchotchkes that are battery-powered that you'd see at Halloween stores, you know, woo, that sort of thing. I mean, that's there. That's where the money is. But it's almost, as I said, an entry point. You know, that popular narrative that just isn't true is a way that lets you actually find out the truth and actually find out who this man is and what he did, good, bad, or otherwise. Again, as historians, it's not our job to determine who's good and who's bad, or who's right and who's wrong. It's our job to understand both sides to get a complete picture. It's sort of up to you on your own to make that decision. But was he a game changer? Is he an important figure? You bet. I mean, this episode's airing in the summer. I could have saved it for Halloween and probably had a lot more hits, but I don't care about that. That's not exactly why I'm doing this. He is a major figure at a very tumultuous time. Remember, you're getting into the age of the Renaissance, beauty and humanism and all of these things that maybe we'll talk about. And this guy's impaling people. Again, in his lifetime, over 100,000 people. But this is a lesson of history. It's important to understand, and not unusual, especially with a season like this, studying the lives in context of individuals. More often than not, they become much more famous in death than in life. There's just recently been a movie release, a Dracula movie, Dracula Untold or something, and I didn't see it, and my students said, no, you have to see it, it's so historically accurate, and, you know, except for when he turns into a bat and drinks blood and makes a pact with Satan and all of these things. At any rate, the story is alive, the story's still here, maybe we can give it a little more context than we have. Thank you for joining us. As always, next week's episode is on you. Visit the Facebook page at facebook.com/BradyJKreitzer. Visit the Twitter at Wartime Podcast. Visit BradyKreitzer.com or WartimePodcast.com. Get in touch with us. Let us know. You pick next week's episode. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.